7 minutes past 10 now on 9 to Noon. Well, our guest now started her plastic-free beauty bar business in her kitchen in Christchurch 8 years ago while studying chemistry at university. Breanne West's idea was simple but brilliant. Why use shampoo and liquid soap in plastic bottles when we can add the water ourselves in the bathroom? Her company, Etique's range of solid shampoo, conditioner, soap and other beauty bars now sell in over 2,500 retailers in 16 countries. And she estimates the company has saved over 9 million plastic bottles from entering landfills here and abroad. In 2015 and 2017, she raised $1 million through crowdfunding. Earlier this year, a group of international investors came on board, putting Etique and its early investors on a firm financial footing and putting the focus on some pretty bold future goals. Breanne West is in the Christchurch studio. Hello and Merry Christmas, Breanne.
Hello and Merry Christmas to you.
It's been another really big year for you and for the Etique team. What does this new capital raise mean?
It's pretty exciting. It's something we've been sort of working on half-heartedly for the last sort of 18 months to a year. It takes a long time to raise capital. And with, of course, the pandemic, that threw a few spanners into the works. As we operate, as you mentioned, in 16 different countries, we're a New Zealand-based team, and my COO, Tristan, and I are the ones who've really travelled out to go and build relationships with all these retailers. And of course, we couldn't do that. So how are we going to continue the momentum and continue to build the company? So we looked to see who was out there still investing in companies that had absolutely bang on brand values, you know, so they wouldn't change what the company was about, but would help us grow. So they had infrastructure in countries like America, the UK and parts of Europe. And we have found a phenomenal partner. They have got some incredibly experienced people on board. And more importantly, for me in particular, is the fact that they really love what the company stands for. So this partnership will allow us to, I mean, obviously financially speaking, we're now in a much better position to expand rapidly as well. But it just means that we can continue doing what we're doing simply by having people out there.
What are some of the other strategic benefits of this? Is it things like distribution chains or just knowing local areas? What's the other, you know, stuff that comes to the table?
The big thing is people. I say it all the time, a business is nothing without the team, and it's so true. And it surprises me that sometimes a lot of businesses and employees don't recognize that. But the people that have come along with this deal have incredibly deep networks. They have contacts with people in retail chains that, you know, ordinarily we just haven't been able to get our foot in the door. Big retailers you'd know the names of. So, you know, we're already reaching out to them and speaking to people they know. It's easier access to things like logistics facilities and other things we just can't access because we just don't know people. Unfortunately, businesses is who you know a lot of the time, not what you know. And these guys just know as many, far more people than we would ever. And that's been a huge help already. And look, we're what, a month and a half in?
You've already navigated some of the most challenging and exciting times for a business, which are those growth spurts that happen quite rapidly. And especially when you begin expanding into various countries. And that can be a danger time as well as a time of great opportunity. You've already been through some of that. What will this new arrangement mean for the growth curve for the company? Again, there's a lot of work to happen. But where do you think you're at on the curve?
I think we're still at the bottom of like they call it a hockey stick, don't they? So there's an awful lot of growth to come. Obviously, a lot of companies measure it in revenue, and of course we do as well, but we don't typically discuss it publicly, but we do measure it in number of bottles saved. So we've actually just hit 10 million bottles today, which is beautiful timing, really. And with that comes a new goal. So we used to say we wanted to hit 50 million bottles by 2025. We are now, with this investment, saying 500 million bottles by 2030, so within the next decade. That kind of goes to show you the amount of growth we're expecting. And you're right, all the exciting, you know, the first time you get into your first big retailer, the first time someone influential posts about you on their social media, those sorts of things have been and gone, but they, you know, they get bigger, the highs will have to get higher to compete with those early ones, but I suspect that they will.
I'm trying to do the maths on the 500 million. I got there on the on the 15 mil. It's about five times size by 2025, and then really, really, really big by 2030. And how do you measure the bottle saved? Literally, whichever product you're selling, you can equate that to what a bottle of shampoo or a bottle of liquid soap would have been. Is it one for one, or a bit more complicated?
It's a bit more complicated. It does depend on the product. So say our shampoo bars, which are, of course, our best seller and what we're known for, they're equivalent to three bottles of liquid shampoo. And you can work that out just by determining what sort of the industry standard is for the active ingredient and diluting it accordingly, because obviously without the water, they are much more concentrated. A conditioner is a bit more impressive at five bottles. But then something like a body wash is simply one. So it does vary, and we factor that in. And I've got a very clever in-house accountant who has set me up a wonderful system who does it automatically, because I used to have to do it manually, which was not my forte, maths.
Not mine either, as you can see, certainly not on Christmas Eve. You mentioned the social media. You mentioned the social media influencers. Now, this is vital to marketing and to advertising, especially when you are moving into a space where your focus and your brand is about keeping plastic out of landfill. So how do you get the word out, and how important is being picked up by one of those big influencers or more?
We're a lot particular about our influencers strategy. We don't work with many at all. We prefer to have long-term relationships with people who have at least one or two similar values. We do a lot of educational posts. So we use social media ourselves a lot to educate people rather than constantly, buy our stuff, buy our stuff, buy our stuff. So the vast majority of what we say online is how you can live a slightly less impactful life on the planet. But when it comes to influencers, yes, they are very effective. And the best ones come from spontaneous relationships. A lot of the bigger ones, so a lot of people know about a story about Britney Spears where she posted us on Facebook back in 2016. We didn't even know it was going to happen, but that drove the most tremendous traffic, as you'd imagine. Millions of people saw that post, and we had no idea. We reached out to her afterwards and we never heard back. So it was sort of bizarre in that regard, but
it's authentic.
They're effective.
It's authentic, yeah. When it happens like that, because the thing with the influencers is it's becoming such a paid business now that a cynicism is going to build up around it. But when someone who just happens to have a bazillion followers genuinely likes something and posts, that's kind of the point.
Exactly. That's why we're particular about who we work with, is we don't want to become inauthentic as a brand. We work with people who genuinely like the products, and then we're very clear that this is a sponsored post. So you know that, yes, their opinions are real, but we are paying them to say these things.
Let's go back to the start of the story. I think you're about 32, I shouldn't say only, but you're well through a business for someone in their early 30s. Where and how did it start? Was it the idea that was just festering in the back of your mind? Where festering's not the right word. germinating in the back of your mind. Where were you at when this began?
There wasn't any real lightning bolt moments. There's a story out there that I dropped a shampoo bottle in the shower and it all gurgled down the drain, and I thought, aha, why do we have water in our products? But really, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I had just sold two previous startups that were very, very small. They taught me a lot about what not to do primarily in business, but they'd both been quite successful from a sales and marketing side. And it turns out I really like telling stories. The problem with those two businesses was I grew bored very quickly because they didn't have a purpose. One was a confectionery company, so I was selling people sugar and fat, which you'll agree, whilst we might like it, nobody really needs it. And the other one was a sort of a bog standard, a typical cosmetics company that was, liquid products. So they were fun and they taught me lots, but I realized that I got bored very quickly. So how would I create a business that would operate with a purpose, that would, rid the world of plastic bottles, operate as ethically as possible, and have an impact on the environment? So plastic-free cosmetics really sprung to mind quite organically from that, because I had the cosmetic chemistry knowledge, I had the science degree. Well, I was working still through the science degree at that point. It all came together quite nicely, because the cosmetics industry is hideous on many, many levels. The supply chains are despicable, full of more traffic, child trafficking than you might imagine. I wanted to prove to the world and offer consumers an option that was genuinely better. Always had big ambitions. I didn't quite actually expect it to get this big. But there you go.
You were studying chemistry, as we said, but you'd always been an entrepreneur. You were the kid who was making lemonade on the side of the road at about six, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a bit weird. I had a pet detective agency when I was eight. We moved to New Zealand when I was seven. So I was born in a country called the Isle of Man, and my parents would go to work and I would hang out at my childminders during the school holidays, and we would always be doing weird things. I was often running around pretending to be a horse, but otherwise I was starting strange businesses like an art gallery, and I cannot draw. So, weird kid.
What does a pet detective agency do? Does it detect pets, or are the pets the detectives, or what?
I think it was an excuse to wander around and look at and chase after animals, to be perfectly honest.
I see.
There was a lot of, well, what I thought was a lot of animals lost in McAndrew Bay and Dunedin back then. So I went out and searched for them. And actually, I did find a cat under a bush.
So were you a peninsula girl, growing up on the peninsula in Dunedin?
Yeah, I was.
All right. So studying chemistry, and was there an intention to head to business while studying chemistry? Was there an intent to become a scientist of some kind? Like, was there any sort of plan around that degree at the time?
No, I don't really do planning, which is terrible. I've always wanted to be something to do with science. I've wanted to be a vet or an oceanographer or a meteorologist or whatever, a geologist at one point. Whatever I was either reading or a movie that had influenced me with some kind of science-based career, and I wanted to be temporarily. So studying science was a no-brainer, but as to what I would do afterwards, I hoped my degree would lead me in that direction. But no, it was never business. I always believe business is the way to create mass and quick positive change for the planet and for people, but I just didn't see myself doing it because I didn't have any business skills. God, I hope that's improved over time, but you know, I didn't know what business really was. So those first two startups really were quite useful in that regard. They taught me how business worked to a degree.
But also business is changing, and you've just alluded to it already, and boy, I bet it changes after the year we've all had. Business is changing in that the old mantra of, you know, minimise costs and maximise profits, consumers, inverted commas, citizens, are moving on from that stuff. Citizens are moving on from being necessarily the suckers for whatever kind of commercial advertising has pushed at us, to being far more picky, and certainly the stories that we listen to are different. So it's changing, and as you've also said, you know, the traditional old advertising model or marketing models are changing as well. So you sort of had your moment where you thought, I've got the idea now, and it's something that's passionate to me. How did you kick it off? How did you get that initial momentum up and running?
I mean, it wasn't overnight. A lot of people seem to think it became a thing immediately, and that's definitely not the case. So for the first year and a half, I ran it out of my flat, and I was still studying part-time, you know, to make sure that everything, that I had time for everything. It was long and slow, but really I started on Facebook. That was back in the day when it was easier to advertise on Facebook because there wasn't the overwhelming amount of business on there that there is now. So you could post something and people would see it. So that was really how it began. But a word of mouth was our biggest marketing opportunity because it's free. So if you create a good product, and more importantly, you explain to people what good that product is doing and what good your business is doing, they will talk about it. So that is the advantage of having a business with a purpose and with a story. So being, you know, wanting to become the world's most sustainable cosmetics company, that inspired people to try it rather than just, here's a shampoo bar, which back then was a product people didn't want to know about because, and still happens now, people think it's just a bar of soap and that it will be horrible for the hair. That story, that purpose has been, I believe, the number one contributor to Atique's success, because that has led people to be as loyal as they are, to try it, to tell their friends and to love it. We have some really, really, I don't want to use it obsessive because it sounds negative, but really, really loyal fans. And that comes because they believe that they are having an impact. And that is such a nice feeling.
Actually, the product idea is one thing, but making the products and products plural is another. And what was that whole investigative process? who did you work with to get a product that not only met your primary goal, but as you say, didn't bring in some other negative that would not play well?
So for the first 4 years, we made them ourselves. I made them in my flat for a year and a half. Then we moved into our first factory, which was amazing. Factory is probably overstating it. It was a small unit and we could make 50 bars a day. So manufacturing these has always been difficult because they're a product that is made very differently to other products out there on the market. So we had to invent it from the ground up. So we moved, we built a custom-built factory in Wigram in Christchurch. It would have been 2016. We moved in April and we outgrew it in November, which everyone's like, oh, that's a wonderful problem to have. But I tell you, it wasn't. It sucked.
Yeah.
So the
Especially with
stress
time to run on
levels.
the lease, I imagine.
We're still in that building and it's a great building, but we don't manufacture there anymore. So we've got some great partners up in Auckland who put 18 months of research, development, money, their expertise into building machinery and working with us to make sure that these products were easy to make on at scale and to keep up with our growth. And more importantly, because we've just released a sort of a really unusual range of what we call concentrates, they've been keeping up with us and our insane drive for new products. We've got about 72 products in the works for next year, which is far too many, any business person will tell you, but there's just so much opportunity to create change that I find it hard to rein those in.
So the next step, when you've got your product, of course, is one of the biggest challenges to any new business, which is to raise capital. And again, this is another way that business is changing, and that the connectedness and the technology is enabling people to raise money. How well did your first Pledge Me go? This was 2015, I think.
It was. I think there've just been a couple of other equity raises. So equity crowdfunding is where you literally sell shares. It's not the reward base where you give people, they give you money and you give them a, I don't know, a product from your company. So I always wanted to do equity crowdfunding because I really love the idea of bringing investors who may ordinarily not be able to afford to invest along the journey with us. And now, 4 years later, 5 years later, they have all done phenomenally well, which is very, very cool feeling beyond all else. But it was terrifying. We knew we needed to raise capital. We came up with Pledge Me idea. I spoke a lot to Anna Gunther, who was the CEO of Pledge Me. And finally, we decided to take the plunge. We got it all ready in 3 weeks, which is far too fast. And I recommend if anyone's considering it to give yourself at least 3 or 4 months. We launched at Ballantine's in Christchurch, who very kindly let us use their salon for a launch. It was very cool. We had people turn up whom I'd never heard of, who put significant amounts of money into this company. And again, they did it because of the story. They didn't know me. They didn't know if I was if I was any use at all. They didn't know anything about the company other than the fact that they loved the purpose. So in 2015, we raised 200K, and we did it again in 2017, and we raised $500,000. And we did that one in 90 minutes. So that one was a dramatic success. The first one was done in 10 days.
Brian, the other big moment for the business when I think you knew you were on a trajectory that's similar to someone lighting a match under a firework was again, this is the new way that word gets out. I think it was meeting a reporter who did an interview with you, and then it went
Yeah.
where? What happened? What happened? It was in Hawaii, I think, wasn't it?
It was. It's probably my favorite business story. I was at a women's leadership or entrepreneurship seminar in Hawaii for 2 weeks, which sounds, just as awful as it was. It was a terrible way to spend 2 weeks. Poor me. And one of the many benefits that came from it was meeting a Forbes reporter. So I had a chat to her, and my God, I was so excited because, Forbes is a big deal. To appear in Forbes, I thought it would set the world on fire. And we'd get inquiries from all around the world, and it would just put a teak on the world map, I guess, is what I thought it would do. The article went online, and I think about 4 or 5 people read it because they used to have a little counter at the bottom of their pages. So I was pretty gutted. Moved on,
And
got back to New Zealand, carried on.
three of those were
Yeah,
you, right?
probably. And two of them were my mother. Got back to New Zealand, sort of forgot about it. About a week later, I got a private message, I think it was on Facebook or something, from a different reporter, and she was from the Huffington Post. And she said, I hope you don't, well, actually, I know I hope you don't mind, but I've just to let you know, I have written your story on the Huffington Post. And that was when I looked at my emails and when we got to work and saw all the orders. And now that had set the world on fire. A lot of people read that article. We had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of orders, hundreds and hundreds of emails and private messages and Facebook messages and phone calls. And it was, I know this sounds like a wonderful problem to have, but at the time it was actually very difficult. So very, I think we were a team of four. And as I said, at that point we were making 50 bars a day. So this was in October. We emailed 95% of all those people and said, look, thanks so much for your offer and your order and your interest. There's just no way we can fulfill this side of the year. And most of those people were incredibly understanding and let us keep the money and work towards fulfilling their order. But I tell you, it was stressful. There was lots of tears. That was it was about two or three weeks later that Britney Spears and Ashton Kutcher both shared it on their social platforms as well, which extended the stress a little, but were good days. But that definitely showed us how much interest was in a product like this, because most of the interest came from the States.
And there's your problem again, challenge in business, which is now you're faced with the potential for epically huge growth, but how do you manage it logistically? How do you manage it financially? What have you learned along the way as you've built this right up now to this new capital raising? Like, what have you learned about how to manageably grow and bring on board and shape a business?
That is a conversation in itself, because it is definitely the moment when most businesses fail. A lot of people think instant growth like that is wonderful, and it is, but my God, you can make some terrible decisions. And I made a bad decision. So I said, okay, let's jump on this and build a warehouse in the US. So we partnered with a logistics company over there, and it was probably the biggest failure within Ateek, because it was just the biggest disaster and cost us thousands of dollars. So we took a step back and we said, right, we need to bring some in-house expertise. So we brought in my COO I mentioned earlier, Tristan, who had masses of experience in building international companies and ones that operate from New Zealand and Australia. So we knew how to sort of set up the logistics and work with retailers. And again, it goes back to people being a business. He taught me how to do all of that as well. Without question, had I not had the people around me, the company would have failed. So the number one takeaway is you cannot do everything. You have to get people in there to do it, to help you and to teach you and to learn from. It was very exhilarating, but it was for a long time on a knife edge. We could have gone either way. You don't make as much money as you think you do when you're trying to build a company. It just sucks money, and you need to invest an awful lot of time and money.
What has COVID meant? I can think of any number of businesses at an exciting growth stage, perhaps exporting for the first time or opening up new operations, and then this curveball came. What did it mean for where you were at?
I feel quite guilty, because we have not suffered anywhere near as much as so many other businesses around us. We are in a good industry, because we're in a hygiene industry. As a result, our sales have not really slowed down. They have maintained. We have grown a little since last year, but we have not grown as much as we would want to. So Deloitte last year named us as, I think, the fourth fastest growing company in New Zealand with 999% growth. That has not happened this year, but that is okay, because I feel very lucky simply to have grown at all. It sped up the decision to make a strategic partnership with our new investment partner, because they had bring on the ability to have logistics offshore and in those contexts, as I mentioned. But the number one, I guess, was making sure that people were safe. And that was the first thing we did. So we did pull in expenses. We made sure that we weren't spending money frivolously, because we did expect it to impact us more than it did. And we just made sure that our team had everything they needed at home. So we sent them home earlier than the lockdown. We made sure they could work from home if they were able to do so. We gave them things they needed to keep themselves safe. We just wanted to make sure that the team were happy and healthy, because they would be the ones who would look after the company. And it paid off. We have a very happy, healthy team.
So the other parts of the social enterprise for you, you've brought in some other projects as tree planting initiatives as well. Just explain the business model and what is a social enterprise and what isn't a social enterprise, and how you feed that side of what you want to do.
Unlike a few other people around the world, I think social enterprises are relatively fluid definition. It's a company that has a purpose that it can demonstrate impact towards, where profit isn't the number one goal. I think that's what you'd call it. And I hope one day social enterprise isn't the word we use. It's simply business, and that the businesses that don't have a purpose beyond just making money are the ones that become the outliers rather than we are. But in terms of ATIC, I guess broadly it means offsetting any damage we do just by existing as a business and manufacturing products. We, of course, use resources. So, tree planting, as you mentioned, we have double offset carbon emissions, for example. We're obviously trying to lower them through, say, the increased use of sea freight. And as we are a plastic-free company, our products are plastic-free, they have a significantly lower carbon footprint as well. But that aside, it's trying to lift people up around us as well. So all of our stakeholders, from our supply chain through to our end manufacturing team, they are all, treated as fairly as humanly possible. So we're living wage certified. So our team is paid at least above a living wage, and obviously significantly above that. We work directly with a lot of producers to produce our ingredients. So the likes of coconut oil in Samoa, moringa oil in Rwanda, or a women's cooperative. We work directly rather than through distributors, so that we can ensure that the price we are paying does actually go to those communities and is therefore used in the best possible way by them for what they need. It's those sorts of things. It's just thinking about every facet. So I guess it's a little exhausting, but you don't have to do it all at once, right? If you just want to improve, I think probably your carbon footprint is a good one to focus for obvious reasons. If you want to look at how you can lower your emissions, then have an assessment done. It's about $1,500, and I appreciate that can be a lot of money for some businesses, but for some it is not. Have someone assess where you could make some serious improvements and work towards that. That is a great first step, and that can be part of your purpose. Being a social enterprise is not a way to, it's not an unprofitable way to run a business. A lot of people think that if you operate for something beyond making money, that means you're unprofitable. But we've been profitable for 3 years, and there's proven research out there that goes to show those businesses that do have a purpose go further, last longer, are more profitable, and have longer customer loyal, greater customer loyalty.
Brienne, I think Siri is calling you.
Yes, she is. I've tried to shut her up now. Honestly.
I think that means our time is up. You've been very generous. Have a lovely Christmas Eve, and all the best for Christmas Eve, and lovely Christmas Day, and all the best for 2021.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brienne West of ETIQ.